population up, 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 and then diversified to within this very monotonous system to produce more diversity again. And we see that again and again in nature. And so I think what you said, this thing, what we are trying with making uniformity in breeding is so against nature that it's really flying back into our faces.
I think that you can also select for plasticity.
Absolutely.
And for example, if you select for families, mm-hmm. you can select for variants within a family.
Yeah.
And then you select for plasticity. And there is selection for plasticity, of course, in behavioral plasticity, for example. But you can also select for canalization, for very strong canalization. Mm-hmm. But again, it's a funny kind of thing, because if you select for canalization, for very, very kind of strongly channeled development, this can only happen if you have a lot of plasticity at the level below it.
Yeah.
Because you have to have a lot of you have to compensate for variability, genetic variability, epigenetic variability, and environmental variability by doing all kinds of things at the level underneath it.
Yeah, I mean, so, if you execute it like wheat, you can do almost anything.
Yeah.
Perhaps it would be interesting, tomorrow we're talking more about plants, but we hear today a lot about animals, and there are some other plant experts here doing breeding. If you could talk perhaps shortly to this topic without telling everything you're going to tell tomorrow.
Other ones who don't.
Or you, for example, you have a huge experience and well, we want to know everything. No, in 2 minutes. No, this flies really noxious. I never about what you already said, that plant breeding going farther than just looking at the genes. It's not just a phenotypic selection. But perhaps, and just always trying to come back to this, what you said, a thing of observing, of relation, of conversation. Does that mean anything for you, or is it just the example here for cows and bees?
I mean, when you work as a breeder and you have an idea, for instance, you want to have, let's say, a special resistance, and you try to make a cross or a selection, and then you can find that all the descendants are ill, will not have the resistance, then you have an answer to a question that you didn't speak of before. And then you have to find a new idea what is happening. For instance, when you make a marker selection and you think that what you have as a marker is corresponding with a special resistance, and then you make breeding and you find that all the descendants have the disease and they have a marker. Mm-hmm. So where is the resistance? I mean, you can find many phenomena in breeding, but on the other side, I can see that what Annette was talking about breeding in cattle, that now it is going to more and more breeding on a genomic base, is also happening in plant breeding. So on one hand, we have more and more knowledge about the genetics, but on the other side, kind of breeding is going more and more in kind of genomic breeding. Not looking to the plants on the conventional breeding. So I think it is very interesting to see all these phenomena that are described during the day today, but on the other side, I ask myself, where is the point to start a kind of breeding by using these changes, these epigenetic changes, but in a rational way? So you can see all these phenomena, but when I start a kind of breeding, I have an idea where to go to. And now the question is how to transform it in the daily work. And this is a question. question I have no answer now.
How do you do it?
How I do it?
Yes.
I'm
asking you because you're not talking tomorrow, so I'm really interested in I know you do great work, and I know you do organic breeding, and it's a pity you can't.
But on the other side, I'm not very successful, so it showed that not all the ideas are related to the market. Yes, I have questions, and I have ideas. I think when I start a kind of breeding in a way of finding new characters. Let me say, give you an example. When I want to have a barley without spot on the grain, it's a normal situation for every barley to have spot on the grain. You cannot see when you have it as a hulls barley because the hulls cover it. The hulls of the barley cover the spots on the grain.
Yeah.
And when you have a hulls barley, you see all these spots. But when the consumer sees the spots, they don't want to buy because they think they are ill. So you have to develop a barley without spots. And now, if you cannot find a barley without, how to develop it? You have to create a new character starting from those that don't have it. And now the question is it possible? And I can tell you, yes, it is possible to start with those that have spots and develop those without. But it takes a long time. That is one side. And the other thing is, what do I have to do to support the plants to be able to develop it? I know that it is necessary, but I have no rational way to explain it in that way.
But
can you understand?
Why not? Why can't you explain it? I mean, if you have, let's say, you select for a genotype that is without spot, but this genotype will only express itself, develop the non-spotty thing in a certain environment, right? This is what you're, so you have to very rationally to make many environments and to see in what environment this particular genotype will be without spots, right? This is what you are driving at?
Yes, of course. Yes, I can explain something
yes.
about this.
So this is very rational to make the selection, the first of all, look at the, look at in many environments.
Okay, and then the question is, where comes this new character from?
It can come, it can be within the genotype already, but it was not expressed because you didn't give him the supporting environment. So it can be there, but you have to induce it.
Yes, I have to induce it.
You have to induce
it. That is a very important aspect to think about. The breeder has an idea, and he has an intention, he has a motivation. And this is working also. You can say this is maybe random, but it is working.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is working, it's becoming a realization in the plant.
That's right.
So what we can find in the new developed plant is the breeder.
Yes.
And I think because when we realize this procedure, we have more to look to the breeders and their development. What has a breeder to develop? To bring his intention into the plant.
Yeah.
And today we only look how to find the technical way to realize that.
Could you even say what a breeder has to do to let come into the world what the plant can give? I know my English is very bad. It's not only what you want to put into the plant or the goals you take for the plant, but you see what is it, what can the plant offer, and what kind of condition do I have to have for that? Maybe that we call typus this morning.
What?
Der Typus.
But I think one thing that makes it so different, breeding from waiting for natural selection, is that sometimes we are trying to get the plants or the animals into a stage that they would not reach through natural selection. And because if you think natural selection, at least when I studied, was like, it's always an uphill thing. Yeah? You have this, what we call adaptive landscapes, that you have through selection, organisms are always moving upwards in their fitness. Yeah? And so at some point they are at a potential maximum, yeah? There may be other maxima, but to reach these other maxima they would have to go through a valley. And that in nature would not happen, because they would simply die. And so what we do as breeders sometimes, we help them through valleys. Mm-hmm. So we may
How do you do that?
For example, we protect plants from certain diseases. That if we keep them out in nature and they go through an extremely susceptible stage, they will simply disappear. And they will not breed anymore. But if I keep them in the greenhouse or somewhere to keep them from getting sick, and then maybe I recombine them with yet other plants in the next generation, and so I get another resistance in there. Yeah? So I can make them survive something they wouldn't survive in nature. And this way, maybe combine things from two different places, more or less. Yeah? And so we oftentimes have this breeding in the initial stages, we may even have genotypes that look awful. And in nature, that doesn't usually happen.
Do you think this is wrong, that we're doing?
No, I think this is just another way. I mean, we are adding something, and but it depends how you work. You may reject this idea, you know? I don't know. But if you look for new resistances and you find them in plants that usually live in the desert, or in a very dry, hot environment, and you bring them to your place, in the beginning it will be a disaster.
I cannot find them, for instance. So when I'm looking at, for example, I'm looking for dry resistant cereals, and I take them from any desert areas, and when I grow them at my place, they have mildew up to the top.
Yes.
So they will not survive till the moment when I can see whether they are useful to be parents for breeding for dry resistance, because they are ill.
Yeah.
So there are problems to solve if I will walk this way.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I mean, and that's for we humans.
What's my question to you?
Thank you.
And I think that's the same thing what Ulrike wanted to say, that
can you talk a little louder?
I think it's the same thing that Ulrike wanted to say, that the breeder gives an opportunity for the plant to come into a situation where it is able to present a trait which is inherent but could not otherwise appear.
But I'm not the plant breeder. My question is, isn't the whole production of hybrids a little bit the same thing, that you make so much in breeding for yield, and this plant is very susceptible to that disease and another one resistance? You're doing a little bit the same thing, or didn't I understand it quite right?
Well,
you're helping it survive, which wouldn't survive at all, and you're making a hybrid, and after it doesn't survive. Well, it's not very fertile anymore anyway.
Maybe you will have recombined the drought resistance with mildew resistance from this example, and then you can deal with it. Yeah? I mean, the most extreme case is a breeder I met who was working on the idea that we need to breed trees instead of annual plants. And he was working with chestnuts in North America. But he wanted to have chestnuts that you could harvest with a combine harvester. And he had an incredible idea, but he went to China where there was a lot of evolution of chestnuts, and where the chestnut blight is not killing the chestnuts, and he found that the Chinese had one chestnut they didn't like, so they always cut it away. So it sprouted, and this thing, within 4 months after germination, would produce flowers and fruit, like an annual plant, but it had a perennial root system. But it was not frost resistant. In Minnesota, he had chestnuts that would survive at 40 below zero in the winter. So he tried to combine these two things, same thing again. He had to work in a greenhouse until he had recombined the frost resistance on the one hand with a habit that has very fast fructification and that you could cut down every year and it would resprout. I mean, it's totally wild. It wouldn't, but it's incredible. What's wrong? Not for me. But it's hybridization. Every breeding is hybridization.
Yeah, I know.
So when the hybrid production, there's a lot of people who have no problem with it. My problem with it is the uniformity that results from it.
But it doesn't.
That depends.
It depends on how close they are.
The modern hybridization, where you have four parental hybridization, is already a lot better than the old ones, where you have two parental ones. But there's a lot of people who argue that there's other things wrong with it, which I cannot really judge.
You want to answer?
If there's something wrong with hybridization.
Yes.
Not hybridization, but hybrids.
With hybrids.
Using the F1, let me say, not making a cross, but using the F1 whole area.
Yeah.
So every plant comes from the same crossing, but the main aspect is that during the procedure of developing a hybrid variety, you are looking for those that make most yield, let's keep it on yield. And so you have to find those inbred lines that make this in one step. And that is that this increase in this one step is a kind of explosion on the level of life. Mm-hmm. And this you transform as a nutritional product to human beings. This kind of substance, which is developed at this moment when these two different parents come together. And what you have to do as a breeder is keeping these parents always away from each other. So this, what you make is a kind of tension between these parents. And you want this explosion in the descent. And then you use this as a kind of food. And now, I think what is done before is the procedure that is realized in the substance. Mm-hmm. And why shall I eat this?
Why not?
I would be very happy if we could have this discussion in German tomorrow.
But I will give my talk in English. I will have German overheads, but otherwise the audience can't follow completely.
Yeah. I think what is necessary to look to this is that during hundreds of years, in all kind of breeding, we changed the environment to a high-yielding environment in every kind.
That's true.
And during the procedure of breeding, it's developed in a way that the plants could only develop on higher yield when their metabolism changed to more starch production. And to reduce any kind of production of second substances in metabolism. Well, I don't know the special word in English. So all these substances that are not necessary to increase the starch production are reduced. For instance, also all the mineral substances because of this lower concentration. So we change any kind of food during 100 years in this way. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what we now are exposed to. All people in the Western world in particular are exposed to such kind of food.
Mm-hmm.
may something say something I'm not allowed to, I guess.
Yes.
What I oppose for hybrids is, of course, not from the plant point of view, but first of all, the universality. Uniformity. And then, through hybrids, there was an absolute enormous concentration of the seed market behind it. That's what I want to talk tomorrow a little bit about. It. But that's so closely married to hybrids and to having to buy the seed every year again that it's in itself a reason to be really very against hybrids. But that's not the discussion now, but I just had to add. Perhaps we here go a little bit back to the animals. Or you want to say something? You have to help me a little bit. I don't know what the, you know, you have to help me. Yeah, and that is it.
Yeah, I just had the idea that there might be a connection between what Ulrike said and what Valerio said. Ulrike and Carl Josef, if I'm understood him right, said that the commitment of the breeder is somehow important for what comes out, belonging to the diversity or to the diversification or the differentiation of the result. So you say today for these breeders he learned that they work with cows that were very differentiating, difficult to handling, so in a kind of were highly developed in taking care of different parts of the environment. But in dealing with these cows, the breeder need to have a lot more of commitment than to cows that are somehow a little bit more than whatever you call it. And there might be a connection that between these two viewpoints. So one can say if the cows are higher developed in the sense that they can deal with different environments, the breeder has to give more commitment. Now turn it around. If the breeder gives more commitment, the cows or the plants can get more the ability to produce diversity. That's my idea.
It's a lot of commitment. They are constantly supervised.
Well, the cows.
The cows, except for the night. So there is always one herder with the animals, and the animals eat more because the herder is there, of course.
They eat more.
They eat more. Yes, they feel reassured by the presence of the herder. No? And of course they live where the animals eat. So the whole is not just an individual commitment; it's a social commitment. The whole society is organized around the fact that they produce cows, and way they behave, the way they think. No, they, I don't know. One feature is the women. Women are supposed to be very looking like that. No? Daytime. At night, no problem. No? Become chatty and move around. Absolutely different personality. No? And you think, what's going on? No? It's a strange thing. No? And in fact, the women are the ones who milk. So it makes very, very much sense that they are appreciated for sort of keeping, you know, it makes you think of, I don't know, Diane Fossey being with the gorillas, no? Keeping a sort of very, very low key, very low profile attitude, no? When they can be seen by the cows. No, but certainly it's a...
Soll ich es auf Deutsch sagen? Ja, also die haben eine sehr enge Verbindung zwischen, das habt ihr ja gehört, aber zum Beispiel die Frauen, die sind tagsüber, sind sie immer so durch, sagen wir im Schweizerdeutsch, so. Und nachts völlig demütig, nachts völlig andere Personen und so, und schwatzen und so. Und er denkt, das könnte sein, vielleicht auch darum, weil die Frauen die Kühe melken. Und wenn die Kühe die Frauen sehen, dann sind sie eben sehr demütig, die Frauen beim Melken. Und kaum können die Kühe die Frauen nicht mehr sehen, dann gibt es auch.
In the film, it's Jima Milky, but that was an accident because his wife had gone to visit the sister or something. So he actually attaches the front leg, I think. And then, of course, they attach the calf so that the cow thinks that the calf is milking, but it's just attached to the leg. But in normal condition, the woman would milk this animal in the open, so no fencing, the animal is not attached, and she would sit like this with the milk between her legs in a very precarious position and just, and the cow doesn't even really move. So they have to have a very good relationship.
And the cow isn't found when the women are making?
No.
But now and again you get the one that is a bit like that, so they get attached. But otherwise, no, it just takes too long.
I would like to add something about social affair, commitment and diversity. Now, in these times, we are very alienated from food production. Huh? We have big stores where we get our food, and there are the experts who are doing the whole stuff. So nobody knows how wheat is growing, how cows are milked. And now it could be, maybe it should become a kind of a social or societal movement that we all want to be committed to food production. So we should start to think over how
events.
How is corn grown, what does a farmer do, etc. And eventually we could somehow free, what you said, this difficult situation where at least cereals are in the hand of a very few multinational companies. And if there would be a social commitment, maybe there would also be social money in order to subsidize local, regional breeding projects.
Like future sowing, this is such an event, what you're doing.
Zukunftssäen.
Yeah.
This is something like that.
Yes. But now this should go a step further and help to start this very important work of local and locally adapted breeding in animals and in plants.
Topic for the next 5-day conference. Other remarks? Yeah.
Just one remark. I don't know whether this is just being a bit hyped up by all the climate change thinking, but I mean, at the moment we're still on a level where we think about wants, and I think
about what?
About wants, what we want. Like you said, Bali, Shana have dots, and that is a want. And if you need to eat something, you would probably have it on the priority list lower, how it looks like. So at the moment we might still be on the want side, but I thought the breeders always have to look far more down the track, so there has to be education as well, like education to tell them we cannot make all carrots that are sweet up to that level because your customers like it, or I cannot have those apples on the market because they're a little bit dotted or something. I think there is something that is not only about the breeding and thinking of what to produce, but also to educate the people who eat it.
That's why we shouldn't eat Linda.
Huh?
That's why we shouldn't grow and eat Linda.
But that latest potato.
It's a potato. Shittiest potato to grow. Terribly susceptible and absolutely moody. That the customers wanted.
Wasn't there a big fight for Linda?
Yes. Yeah. But from the point of view of plant production, it's an awful thing.
But that is epigenetics. That is, they are attached to the time of Linda is this, and this is my grandmother still have Linda, and that is epigenetics in human beings.
From a special point, I think absolutely opposite. I think it is necessary not to accept all these differences, but more to look what quality I want as a consumer, what kind of quality. For instance, sometimes it might be good to have some spots, but...
To have some
spots.
I didn't understand.
But the most important thing is to look that I want to have real quality, which is good for myself to do the work all the day or not only the work. So that is the question. Not to accept a poor quality, but to look for the best quality and not the cheapest.
But it's really a problem if we are going to breed. We breed for all the people or for the best quality when we eat it. That's what's in our mind. And then there's the reality that says if we don't breed varieties that are taken in the market, you don't have to do anything. And the goals coming out from this are on the opposite of that, what is my Einsicht?
Insight.
Often. And in this, between these goals, it can not be very comfortable, because you think one thing, and you have to do the other thing, sometimes. This because the consumer is not, you can tell him, you can be very pedagogically and tell him it might be better if you eat less and it would be more healthy, but you are so small, and man kann überreden. Soll jetzt das und das essen, weil es gut ist, bitte übersetzt mich gleich mal, weil es gut ist für ihn, sondern das sind ja ganz eigene Gesetzmäßigkeiten, die am Markt gelten. Und die sind natürlich für uns auch gültig, weil wir jetzt hier in dieser Situation züchten müssen.
The problem is hard to convince people that they should eat something just because it's good for them, but they have other desires also, and that's what the breeders have to bow to, basically. React to
it. You want to say something as a breeder too? A tree breeder?
Okay.
Not the last. I want to come back to the initial thing. Breeding is more than genetics, and it's breeding is some kind of conversation.
Conversation.
Is that, can you, does that ring a bell with what you're doing?
Yeah.
You have to present yourself. Well, he is breeding apple trees, so.
Yeah, okay. Some remarks. We spoke about the genetic base of our cultural plants. And the apple tree has a very small genetic base. If we look at the main varieties on the market,
Golden Delicious.
No, Golden Delicious sit in 2/4 of the apples. No, 2/3 of the apples you buy in the shop, there sit Golden Delicious in. This was always crossing with Golden Delicious because Golden Delicious has so many good
genes.
Yeah. So let's say good genes. Okay. There's only 6 old varieties which were not breeded. As Golden Delicious was not breeding, as a Cox Orange, as a Morgenduft, and Jonathan, and maybe another one or 2 other ones, are the base of nearly all our apples we find in the shop now on the market. That's one side of this very small genetic base. And the other is that when we go back, when Apple came to Europe and get domesticated, this was already a very small genetic base. So you
have... When was it? Which time?
Maybe 3,000 years. About. So in the beginning, when we domesticate, we have a small genetic base. And then during 2,000 years, 3,000 years, the varieties got very much. Romans had half a dozen varieties of apples, and now worldwide we have maybe 10,000. And from this, all varieties, these 10,000 which were not breeded by a human in a sense of modern breeding or gezielte Züchtung.
Targeted.
Yeah, yes, breeding. So these 10,000 have developed only by the environmental factors and the human carrying these trees. And now from these 10,000, we reduced again on about 6.
That's the wrong statement.
So that's a phenomenon. And we have now apple breeders which go to Kazakhstan, to the forests where we find wild apple trees, to find some new genes for our apples, to help our apples. So, against fire blight, against all diseases, they want to find some genes, and they find some genes, and want to put them in the apples. And the shortest way is to put them in the apples by genetical techniques. And the other way is maybe that we work with this small genetic base we have, but we look how we can bring it into environment, bring forces to this old genes to get new new health. And for me it's not excluded that we can find a way to work with this small genetic base, maybe not only the 6 varieties, but the small genetic base, and find a way to get health and vigor for the future apples.
Thank you.
So, a little
statement. Is there another question? Otherwise, I will come to a last term here. Yeah, short question.
I would be sensitive. Like, I got the impression that you said if you leave them to the environment and to the ways they like to do, then they will recover their health, and that might be a good way to fight Varroa off. I got the impression, I'm naive, I have no ideas about bees yet, so I got the impression like bees will die out because there is not so much bee food around, the diversity is missing in plants. So my question was, is that so, or do you have another opinion about that? Are they adaptable? Will they learn? Will they cope?
No, we have been talking about one problem among many problems for bees. And pesticides in the agriculture, the lack of flowers, electrosmog, etc. All this helps reduce the bee vitality. But nonetheless, as a beekeeper, you can try to do the best to increase vitality. This does not mean everything is okay, but you can say, I try to do my best for for the bees. And then again, it is a kind of a question of the society, whether we can transform our landscape into flowering landscapes, whether we can really start to reduce pesticides and things like that. So, you are right. The bees are not in a good shape.
Well, I'm coming to a last round. I asked before this, we started the discussion, everybody of you, to give on the last round, at the most 2 minute short take home message from everybody of you. The most difficult task I can ask, I know. Just at the most 2 minutes, what's the most important message you want to give to all our friends? Shall I start with you, or again, or shall I, well, we can also start this one with this. Take the man first.
First, I have to be patient to wait half an hour, and I should be the first without reflection. My take home lesson here is, we have heard a lot of experts about different aspects of evolution and breeding. But what we need for the future is the interest of the lay public. So the non-experts in these questions of evolution and breeding. And I would like to see that in 5 or 10 years, there will be people from the street asking, what are you doing? And to tell the experts what they would like to see in 2 or 3 or 4 year time. So I would like to see the question of science getting back into the public.
Thank you.
That was for me, I think I said my 2 minutes before, taking about 15, so.
Yeah, you can't skip this one, not that nicely. But you have 2 minutes, I look at the watch.
All right, maybe that there is a, there are people out there working and producing from the noise, in a way. Using the what we see as a noise, using the problem as a solution, which is a nice idea. It is possible to see it that way. Just think about that.
Using the problem as a solution.
Using what we frame as a problem, but we always frame historically as a problem, you know, lack of uniformity and stability.
Yeah. Okay.
They use it as a solution. Okay. They use it as a resource. They made a resource of it.
Did
anybody
understand?
Thank you.
Give an example.
If
you don't understand.
Yeah, well, that's what you told all about.
He didn't have my 2 minutes.
You didn't listen. The lack of uniformity and stability in the environment, and that's exactly what they exploit. They exploit unpredictable variability, you know, non-uniform distribution, and made it into a resource. So, it's just different perspective. You know.
So it is possible to see...
Your 2 minutes?
I tried to explain. No,
you 2 minutes. Come on.
Okay. We talk about this later. I just thought that the future in breeding should be on relations. Relations animal breeding, animal human relationships, but also animal environment relationships. We should put our attention on those two factors for breeding.
I think it's very important to think about plasticity, to select for plasticity, because not always, but often, and also to realize that that plastic responses can be inherited, that there is more to heredity than DNA variations.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. You all four were so obedient and docile in 2 minutes that we are.
So now you've got 5 minutes. 5 minutes all for you now.
Yeah, now it's your
turn. 4 minutes.
No, I'm not allowed to say anything.
Yes, you are.
But I think it was a nice finish anyway. And I think we deserve to have a drink after that.
Thank you.